Jake. Thanks, Jake. Great to see a nice crowd here after club night. It always takes a little bit out of us, but in a really good way. So I'm going to talk about, well, you know what I'm going to talk about, so I don't have to say it again. It's interesting, we in the beer world, and I think it's really in all areas of history, you guys have all seen Roadshow, right? And there's somebody always brings something in, and Grandma said, oh, this is our family quilt. Abraham Lincoln died on this quilt. Right? And it turns out that the fabric in the quilt actually came from a dime store in the 1930s. Right? But Grandma kind of maybe embellished the story, or maybe it was her great-grandmother or whatever. So we have these family stories. And a lot of what we see in the brewing literature are basically that. They're family stories. They're tales that have been told again and again and again, and they get modified and changed, and the marketing people use them, and people get confused, and journalists don't always get the story right. And so they get kind of changed all the time. But our brains, that's how we think, is in stories. And if you think about any major religion, you could summarize all the really important points of any religion on an 8.5 by 11 sheet with a few bullet points. But it takes several thousand pages in a book like the Bible to really help people understand what that means, right? Because you got to tell it through stories. And it's the same with beer. So it's just the way we work. And it's the way we're built as creatures. The other thing is that people who write about beer are often journalists, but are not that often historians. Right? And of course, all of us, my generation and a lot of other people, came to know about beer through Michael Jackson primarily. He was the first guy to really like open our eyes to what beer was and could be. And he was a very good journalist, but people would tell him their family stories about the beer and he would write it down and make you feel really great about it, but it didn't necessarily mean that that was historically accurate. So he was a journalist, not a historian. Turns out history is kind of a pain in the butt to do. Right? Talking to people, getting their stories, tasting their beer, that's really interesting work. But the history, it's interesting, but it's a grind. Because you're so often just searching for that one little piece of information, or you only have one tidbit. And I'm going to show you a few things today. There's one data point that like opens a whole world of possibilities, and it's always like you want to open the treasure box. It's like getting a peek inside, but you don't have the key to get in it. You know, so you're always searching for those, starting with one little piece and kind of trailing it off. The other thing is I do think it's important to get it right, to really get the details right, to understand what we're doing. If we're basing our beers on historic styles, and that's kind of what we're doing, I mean, we're reinventing them for sure, but it's always helpful. Always the real picture is richer, fuller, and much weirder than the stories, right? So that's a good thing. So the part of the thing also is that beer history is very specialized, and what that means is we have a very small literature, a few people writing about it, and people tend to copy off each other over time. One person writes a book or some article in 1850, the guy in 1890 copies it, the guy in 1920 copies it, the guy in 1950 copies it, and nobody's really doing the critical stuff. And it's really hard to get down there and dig the data. If you're interested in beer history, you should know two names especially, Ron Pattinson and R. Martin Cornell. I see a lot of heads nodding here. Guys have done the work. They've got access to some of the brewing archives in the UK and elsewhere. Also, I got to give some credit to Stan Hieronymus. He's not here this weekend, but Stan does an enormous amount of research, and he gets the facts right. So his books are very reliable. So a lot of these problems are marketing problems, right? Because breweries, I mean, even think about today, think about a very famous North American, well, now South African brewery who makes a beer that they advertise as being triple hopped, even though that beer uses no actual hops, right? It's all fractionated hop compounds. So because the ad guys are like, oh, that's really cool. We use three kinds of phony hops. Let's call it triple hop. And then the internet is a great resource, but it's also a great propagator because it's so easy to cut and paste. And so you see something, it gets cut, it gets pasted, it gets cut and pasted and tweeted and retweeted. And so all of those problems we have are magnified by the ease at which information can spread through the internet. Good information and bad information. right? So we have to be on our on guard about that. And, you know, I grew up in the 60s, kind of came up, you know, and came of age in the 60s in that boomer generation. And our motto at that time was question authority. But really, when you're doing history, you have to question everything. You have to really make sure that you document and get that right. So the other thing is we do like things to be simple. And in actual fact, history is complicated. So you have to wrap your head around it. There's always a lot of variability in terms of these styles, especially if you think about, we have such good communication now. We have people in this room from all over the world who are all traveled and they're connected on the internet all the time. In those old pre-industrial societies, people lived in villages. They maybe never left the village their whole lives. And so the styles were much more localized, and every brewer did it a little differently, and every village did it differently. We'll see that when we're looking at 19th century Belgium, how many different styles there were in the country, and a lot of variations even within them. And then the other thing is that you got to always remember that with styles, there's always a definite context. When you think about a style like porter, it's a different beer every generation for 200 years, right? So you can't really say what's a porter. You can only say what's a porter in 1850 or in 1920 or whatever it is. So there's no single answer. They're not immutable things. They're flowing stories and traveling road trips. So I have to think about that. So what do we have to work with? Well, there are a lot of period books. It's really great. You could probably spend $10,000 on old books and still not have all the stuff that's out there on the internet right now, and there's a lot more work to be done on that. So there's a lot of great, you know, all the great classic brewing texts, Combrun and Richardson and the London and Country Brewer, and this Belgian book I'm going to talk about by a guy named Lacombre. If you can read French, that's online for free. And so there's a lot of really great stuff out there for you to work on. And we also, I like to cast a pretty wide net when I'm looking at history, so I'm always interested in the trade journals, and also with especially the ads in trade journals, because they show a lot of things, images and bottle caps and bottles and machinery, and you can really get a great picture of what people are doing, not just by the journal articles, but by looking at the more general stuff. And that's true for more general journalism, too. You find in the 19th century a tremendous public interest in things like breweries in different countries. So you'd find Harper's Weekly doing a story on breweries in England or Germany, English breweries doing, or English publications doing stories on beer. And so you find not only articles, but nice illustrations. And again, the technical books often leave off a lot of stuff that they assume the brewers already know. So it's great to have the popular accounts because they tell us things that we wouldn't necessarily get in the trade books, but you have to be a little skeptical of them too. I had a journalist interview me once, and then when the article appeared in the newspaper, I had my hands holding some malt, and the caption said, Randy Mosher holding barley seeds. Or no, beer seeds. You know, he was very lazy journalist, but so you always have to be. I mean, you've seen bad information, and you know it really makes you wonder about journalism when you hear a story, a subject matter you know well, talked about, and it makes you wonder, man, did these guys get anything right? So sometimes they do, and of course, there's academic papers. Unfortunately, they're really crazy expensive. So unless you got a friend or something that's got some university connections or really know how to work the library systems, you'll have a hard time with this. Something that's an enormous frustration to me. And of course, we're lucky as homebrewers; we can do a lot of experimental archaeology, right? We can make the beers that we read about and bring them back to life again. You know, and I've done that a number of times, and I'm getting ready to do a whole bunch more for a project I'm working on, of which this talk is sort of a little bit of a prelude over the next 3 years or so, to do a big book on beer history from a beer point of view, like what did it taste like, right? And so do some of that experimental archaeology. And I also, being a visual person, I love visual searches, and I love trying to bring visual materials into the work I do, and it gives a bigger, richer picture and often shows us things that we would have no idea just by reading the text. So, and here's a great example. This is a picture. I don't know how well you can see it, but this is a beverage called Kvass, and the title is Kvass Dealer in Livonia. That's not the Livonia in Michigan. That's the original Livonia up around on the Estonian border. I think it shares a border with maybe Russia and Lithuania, somewhere up there around the mid-19th century or late 19th century. And it looks like a pretty desolate place, right? You can see some heavily pruned trees that maybe are some fruit tree of some type. There's a drunken guy sitting on a post with a big, probably a leather tankard, a bombard. There's a guy with an accordion or a balalaika or something. I guess it's a balalaika. So there's a little bit of a party going on. It's kind of a dreary scene, but there's a party. There's a drunk guy. That tells us something, right? There's alcohol there. People have walked a long way with their buckets and tubs and pitchers to get some beer. The beer seller's kind of in the back. It's a little hard to see. But just this one picture out of a general interest newspaper, it's really given us a lot of information about a particular time and place where they drank this kvass, which was a rye, low-alcohol beer, still being made today, actually. There's actually a company in Toronto that makes a pretty good, actual, pretty authentic kvass that we can get in Chicago at the ethnic markets. But so I like to look at labels, old advertising materials like signs and things like that, antique prints, just like the one there, illustrations in books, in articles, paintings. So I love going to museums. I spent a great afternoon in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and look at, taking pictures of people drinking with the past glasses, and they've got a huge collection of old drinking ware and everything. And I find that really evocative and interesting. And sometimes you can learn a lot about how it integrated into life, what the beers look like, right? I'm going to talk about Bock beer. I have a question about color in Bock beer, and pictures really tell us a lot that the books never mention. Right, so color is one of those things the books don't talk about much. And then there's physical objects, like this thing. Is this a mind bender or what? Right, this is 500 BC. This is like that movie 300. These are the people that were fighting the Greeks at the time, King Xerxes folks. This is a drinking boot. This would be a terrible vase. Right, this could possibly serve nothing else than to drink, and it's a drinking game, you know, where you hold the boot with the toe up and it splashes your face if you don't know what you're doing. It has that element of all good drinking games have, that the old guys have to be able to beat the young guys. Right? Skill triumphs over boldness. That's a facet of a drinking game that's just absolutely essential. So today I'm going to have some answers, some things that are definitely here. I can tell you this is a fact, and then that's the way history is. Once you have one more fact, now you have two more questions. And so that's the chase. So if anybody's interested in the chase, I got a lot of information for you. And if you got anything, you know, that you know about some of these things, by all means, get in touch. I'm not hard to find. Some of these problems are big problems, like how did lager originate? We still don't really know. We have some ideas. We have some general things we think are probably true, but we don't have a really good, totally laid out exposition of that. And I had to include this Mark Twain quote because I always like him, but he says, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. So when we learn about one thing, it generally kind of applies to other things too. That's the other great thing. So when you get in the really earliest part of time, I don't know how many people were in that talk yesterday about the ancient history of beer. Fascinating topic and a very well done presentation. If you didn't see it, I'd urge you to go online later and have a look through that, because there's a lot of really great information. It turns out hop beer, the earliest chemical evidence of hopped beer is actually from Lombardy. That's the region of northern Italy above that Milan is part of. So I imagine in Germany there's a bunch of archaeologists digging holes and scraping stuff off of pots because, you know, they can't let that stand. Right? Because, you know, I mean, they want to own that. But that pushes doesn't appear to have been too widespread, but again, we don't have that much evidence, so it may turn out that the hop beers really have more of a history before about AD 900 than we thought. But AD 900 is about where they start. But and then there's this thing called gruit. And it uses this, at least always references an herb called bog myrtle or ledum palustre. Myrica gale. And that's a fairly pleasant, resiny kind of thing. They still use it in Scandinavia. They use it in baking. They make schnapps out of it. Some microbrewers make beer out of it a little bit. It has a nice taste. It's almost kind of a hoppy sort of flavor in a way. But then there's these other things like yarrow that get mentioned, and a thing called wild rosemary or ledum palustre. And they're pretty nasty. They're very astringent and medicinal, phenolic, eucalyptus in a nasty way. They're just awful. They'll kill bugs. right? So why were people drinking these things? You know, they're kind of psychoactive, but not in a really nice way. Sort of like PCP, you know, or something like that, like really bad drug. So it's really hard. You know, there's something, we just don't know. We're missing some stuff there. What else was in it? How did they make it? Of course, it was a secret thing, so we don't know. And we may never know. But, you know, how do people drink it? And my supposition always is the people who really knew how to make good beer, it was really good beer. Because people wrote poems about it, and they had gods and goddesses, and it was revered and celebrated in the culture. And even with very simple technology, with people paying attention and with good knowledge passed down generation to generation, you can make very delicious things with very simple tools. So I always assumed that the best beers were good. Now, quality control, you know, it's an issue. But I always assume, start with the assumption that they're not that different than us and in their tastes. So it's us that are getting it wrong on a lot of these areas. So you've all by now heard the story about Porter. I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but there's this famous story about Ralph Harwood in a bellbury in Shoreditch in 1721. And the interesting thing is that it turns out that story was written in a magazine article in about 1770 or so. And that exact story just got copied from that article to another, to a book, you know, and so that was the story. It is probably true that the beer, that Porter sort of replaced a beer that was a blend. There certainly were the blends. There were three threads where they'd take a weak beer, a stronger, fresher beer, and a really aged beer and mix them together, and they'd get all the qualities of all of those things that people liked. And it was less expensive than drinking the strong, sour, aged beer, or not really sour, but aged beer. So that's probably true. And we know that the name was applied about 1725, 1722, something like that. That was the earliest name, Porter. And it was definitely a hoppy beer. You know, we think about Porter today as not being very hoppy. The style guidelines put it in a low hop category, but it was originally quite a hoppy beer. As hoppy, it appears maybe even as IPAs, but a dark beer. And there was the strongest Porter called an entire butt beer that was probably, you know, 1080 gravity, something along that line, 1085. And then there was another one just underneath it called Stitch. And Stitch was a not very hoppy porter that was almost as strong as the entire butt. And then when you went even weaker, it got hoppy again. So it was this weird thing, you know. But the interesting thing to me is about porter and how did it get so big, right? Because it was really the first industrial scale beer that the world had ever seen. And it was really big. It took more money to start a porter brewery than any other kind of business in England except for a bank, right? So more than a shipbuilding company, so that was a big deal. And, of course, London was a very large market at the time. It was the biggest city on earth. People had been moving into London after the fire and the plague in the 1660s. And so a lot of the gentry were leaving the country farming lifestyle and moving into mercantile activities and shipping and trade and commerce and manufacturing in London. So there was an enormous influx of people and money. And, of course, when you have manufacturing and you have commerce, you need a lot of people to do the work, to move stuff around and all of that. And Porter found a home with the people who were doing the work. And so it took a year to age beer. And the brewers were finding that it was really expensive. You know, if you're a craft brewer today and you have to put every beer in a tank and you have to wait a year and you have to have enough tankies to hold all your beer for a year, man, that's not a business. You know, so the money guys came in and said, well, we'll buy that beer. We got money. We'll sit on the money and then we'll get the profit that we'll make by that period. It's like money in the bank, right? It's beer in the tank. And so after a while, they started asking themselves, why are we buying all this beer? You know, wouldn't it just be cheaper to brew it? And yes, it would be. So then you find these families getting into brewing. And that was the beginning of those big breweries like Whitbread and some of those others that were famous in that era. So, and the other thing, of course, you know how big money works. They get in, they get friends in Parliament, they tweak the tax system in the form of having a greater allowance for wasted beer that didn't get taxed. So they gave themselves another advantage over small brewers by tweaking the system. So that gave them a further advantage and further forced the scaling. So we still have a lot of questions about Porter. One of the interesting ones is, did brown malt convert itself? Can you make a brown malt, really brown color malt, that will have enough enzymes to convert? It's right on the edge. You know, and some of the recipes say that they made beer with nothing but brown ale malt, People have tried to make the brown ale malt, and it's very hard to convert, so it's not clear what's going on with that. There's an experimental archaeology thing for you right there. I know some people have fooled around with that. The other thing is that the traditional kilning techniques for that brown malt, it was actually, some of the kilning techniques actually puffed the malt and created what was called a blown malt. It was like popcorn, right? So a very hot fire, generally a wood fire. And so the beer was always describing as having a bit of an empyreumatic aroma to it, so a smoky smell. So here's the question, how smoky was porter? Right? Was it always a smoked beer? You know, up until the point where brown malt no longer became the main aspect of it, which was after Richardson did his experiments with the hydrometer that showed the brewers how little extract they were getting from that malt. Because the problem with malt was that they're buying it by volume, not by weight. Right? So they're buying bushels, well, quarters, which is 336 pounds today, but at blown malt poofed up, that fills a bushel with a lot less weight. Right? So that was why there was such a dramatic change. In percentage of extract terms, it's not that different. But in terms of extract per unit of volume, huge difference. So the recipes all changed in 1780 or so. And then, of course, there's this term called stale that the English always applied to their aged barley wines, and all their aged beers. And that stale was not a pejorative term. It was that term that we would say bready, funky. You know, vinous is another word that was often used to describe the character of this stale. And it was not sour. Because every one of those old English brewing books, the last chapter in the book is always 92 ways to cure sour beer. And they put roasted crab eyes in there and oyster shells and all this crazy stuff, basically alkaline material to kind of counteract that, so to kind of rescue the sour beer. So we know it wasn't that. We think it was probably Brett, but we don't have good evidence for it. But, you know, Brett lives in oak. Stands to reason. We think it probably was. So then there's the other story about pale ale, and you probably also know the story. But here's a slightly different take on it that I find even more remarkable, that we always assume, because Burton is now associated with IPA, and that water that they have there is really good for IPA, we make that assumption that they became famous because that water is great for IPA. And it's just not true. They became famous first for a dark, thick, heavy, sweet, dark amber-colored beer called Burton Ale. It's nothing to do with IPA. And so they had been famous for that for 100, 200 years, long before IPA ever started to be brewed in Burton. And so that's a bit of a conundrum. And, of course, we know the myth that IPA was a special beer brewed for the Indian market. Turns out that it really wasn't. It actually was an October beer. Again, you probably heard this story a little bit. Here's a poem. I got to read this because it's such a great poem. Then sated hunger bids his brother thirst. Produce the mighty bowl, the mighty bowl. Swelled high with fiery juice, streams liberal round, a potent gale, delicious as the breath of Maya to the lovesick shepherdess on violets diffused, while soft she hears her panting shepherd stealing to her arms. Nor wanting is the brown October, drawn mature and perfect from its dark retreat of 30 years, and now his honest front flames in the light refulgent, and not afraid, even with the vineyard's best to vie. Do you want to drink that beer or what? All right? It's like, man, these people love their beer. You know, and that's why I love the poems and stuff. And there's a lot of information. There's a couple of old books that were collected, poems written in the late 19th century that people were digging through history about poems about beer. And they're just fun and fascinating, really cool. So In Praise of Ale is one of them. So we know that this big October beer that they were brewing, it was brewed in private estates. All those gentry that were moving into London, right, they took that beer with them, and then there started to be a fad for it in London in the early 19th century. Always described as the best beer in England, hands down. They grew their own malt and didn't pay tax on it for quite a while. They grew their own hops often. They had a butler or a brewer on their property. A lot of the early brewing books were actually written for those guys because the professionals had a network and apprenticeships and they could learn in London and places. But these guys are all out over the country in the 18th century and early 19th, and so they needed books. So a lot of those books, like London and Country Brewer, that's kind of aimed at those guys. So they're pretty cool books because they kind of give you a lot of information and make it in a kind of a plain spoken way and not the later more highly technical scientific texts like Richardson and Combrun. And these beers were often aged for a couple of years, sometimes quite a lot more than that, as you just heard, and they were massively hopped. So, oops, wait a minute. Oh, yeah. So this was brought into the India trade. Ships can't sail empty, right? So they were bringing back loot and booty from India, basically silk and gold and jewels and ivory and, you know, whatever else. And so going outbound, they had to fill the ships up. So everybody who was working on those ships got a certain amount of cargo space for free. And ale was great because it was heavy, and they could put it down in the hold below the waterline where they needed the weight and to keep it relatively cool, relatively cool. The ocean's never too warm out in the deep ocean. And so they started shipping porter down there and this October beer. And a guy named Hodgson really had the trade. And he, I guess, was just a huge asshole. And Hodgson eventually ended up pissing off everybody he dealt with. If another brewer tried to sell beer to the East India Company, he would cut his price in half to get them out, and he just was always trouble. And so eventually the guys that ran that East India Company kicked him out. And it just so happened that the Burton brewers, who had been selling a lot of beer up to the Baltic, up to Russia particularly, but also everywhere else in the Baltic, the Russians kicked him out because they were trying to modernize the country. They built their own breweries. Thanks for the beer. It was great. We'll do it from ourselves. And, this guy from Allsops is sitting in a gentleman's club bemoaning his loss of this lucrative market. And the guy's like, you know what, this Hodgson guy, they just kicked him out. You might be an opportunity for you. And so Burton had to reinvent their beer. And I think that's probably the nucleus of that story that got its way into Bass advertising materials and things, and where Burton guys really did have to make a new malt that was paler in color, cut the gravity, make the beer much more attenuated, have a lot more hops in it. So the Burton guys really had to reinvent the recipe on their terms to brew it at their breweries because they'd never brewed anything like that before. So I think that was probably why we have this myth about the reinventing, because it was really, it wasn't the beer, it was Burton that had to reinvent themselves. So just an interesting twist on that. Now we have the story of lager. And the story that you kind of hear in the simple books is that, it was brewed by monks in the caves and the Alps. And there's so many problems with that story, it just doesn't make a bit of sense. Not the least of which is if you're brewing in the mountains, everybody's down below in the villages, right? How good are the brakes on your ox cart? Right? Because beer's heavy. You don't like to ship beer around, and they're not running a pipe down the mountain. So, like Swiss cheese, you can make a big wheel and roll that sucker down the mountain. That's why Swiss cheese is hard. All those Alpine cheeses are dense and compact because they're trying to get the water out so they can get it down to the market. But you can't do that with beer because it's mostly water anyway. We do know that there are some hybridized yeast, that yeast at some point picked up genetic material from another form of yeast called Saccharomyces uvarum. It is believed that there are two main groups of yeast, one of which has actually lost most of its original Saccharomyces cerevisiae genetic material and is now mostly Saccharomyces uvarum. But if you know anything about yeast, you know that it changes, the taxonomy of yeast changes about every month. And I think the Wikipedia page, from what I can figure out, is pretty current. So if you want to get the full story, look at the Wikipedia. It seems to be pretty new information. And Chris and Mogens at White Labs kind of verified that it's like, that story sounds about right. So, but it's also believed that there are some lager yeasts that don't have any sac uvarum in them at all. So they're pure sac cerevisiae strains. And interestingly enough, there are also ale strains that are not lager strains that are hybridized yeast. And they tend to be the yeast that are alcohol tolerant, and they're also low pH tolerant, and may also be cold tolerant as well. We don't know. I didn't ask that question. So, but at any rate, looks like probably lager did not develop in Bavaria either. Which, if any Bavarians in the room, because that makes you sad, right? Because Bavarians own lager, right? But it turns out that. Our earliest records of bottom fermentation is in Franconia. Now, I think that's technically part of Bavaria, but it's north. It's not down there by Munich. It's up in, Bamberg is Franconia. And 1302 and 1325, that's a long time before the Bavarians were interested in brewing at all. the Bavarians didn't, they were mainly wine drinkers until the 1500s. And if you look at the founding of all of the major breweries in Munich now, they were all in the late 1500s and 1600s, with the exception of I think, Weinstephan, which was a monastery. Some of those were a little bit earlier. But the commercial breweries like Spaten and those breweries were all founded in around 1600 or shortly after, you know, a little bit after the Rheinheitsgebot, which was 1516. However it happened, it took off pretty big. The Rheinheitsgebot, interestingly, you know, that's the famous beer purity law that they always hit you over the head as, you know, evidence of their superiority in the brewing world. But it actually was a tax enforcement law and just a lot of kind of straighten out all the rules and regulations. It kind of makes like a modern law in a lot of ways. But it allowed competition between the various types of organizations that were making the beer, like church and state and private. And so it allowed a kind of a system of competition on quality that allowed the quality and production methods in Bavaria to really grow over the years, and it developed as a common thing and really kind of grew healthily because of that Rheinheitsgebot. So, and interestingly, it allowed caraway and juniper, which is pretty weird in a beer purity law, so kind of funny. Now, Bock, we have some problems with Bock. It is definitely a strong lager, always has been. There's some problems with the name. You know, I grew up in Indiana, and when I was about fifth grade, they told us, teachers, like, oh, we're going to talk about Indiana, and, you know, we're called Hoosiers. And Hoosiers, we think, you know, that the old settlers that came, they were kind of stupid, and not, well, they're not educated, and so people would knock on their log cabin doors, and the guys inside would go, Hoosier. And I never, in fifth grade, I'm like, no, I don't believe that story. So this is one of those, you know, it seems just not really right. So the Einbeck was a city in the north, southern, northern Germany, very famous as a brewing center, connected with the Hansa Group, which was the northern cities that had a shipping and trade league, very important in late medieval times in Europe. And Einbeckische Bier somehow got translated in Einpackische Bier in Bavarian, because the dialect was and still is different down there. And then Einpackische Bier got translated to Einpack Bier, and then Bock Bier finally. And I just don't think that's right. But, you know, we don't know. The other thing that's always bothered me a little bit about Bock Bier, if you look at the BJCP standards, and American Bock Biers tend to be dark, right? But I don't really think that's the case. If Einbeck was the source of Bock Bier, which it may have been, but maybe not. Also, you think about, like, would the Bavarians have been able to make a dark beer on their own without learning it from the Einbeckische people? Yeah, probably. Because everybody did. The Sumerians made a strong beer, right? So anybody who makes beer knows you can make different strengths. It's not rocket science. So anyway, if it's associated with Einbeck, there's a greater likelihood that beer may have been pale in color. Because most of those beers associated with the Hansa were light-colored. They were mostly white beer brewing cities. Hamburg, Bremen, Hanover. A lot of those places were white beer brewing towns, meaning they had wheat in them. They were also early hop beers. And we know Einbeck was a hopped beer. And we know also that they had air-dried malt. Long before they had English indirect kilning technology, air-dried malt was common across northern Europe. So this is where I like to do a little visual searching. These are three paintings from Germany. The one on the right from 1900 actually says Munich on that menu that's sitting on the table. The other two, I'm not exactly sure where they're from. But it very clearly shows that beer being not brown, but very clearly an amber color. That's why I love paintings. You know, artists really like to get those details right and make those, you know, artists love beer. They're in love with that subject, so they want to do it justice. So there's two. You can see the dates. The one in 1900, the background's a little darker, but it still doesn't really look to me like a really dark beer. And that seems to be typical when you find them. Here's a couple of French paintings by Manet. And this is a little later. One of them is, one of them isn't. There's a color change over the year. It's just one data point. It's not enough to make a supposition on. But it's interesting anyway to see. And clearly amber-colored beers and not brown beers. So now we're going to jump across the channel, or jump across the border, I guess, jump across the Rhine to Belgique. And there are a lot of problems with our understanding of Belgian history. A lot of really silly stories. One of our problems is that we don't have a great written history. There's no academic book I've ever seen or heard of on Belgian brewing. We have some in English, on English brewing, but There's one book called Beer by Belgium, Belgium by Beer. That's actually a pretty nice book, but it's kind of a mess, sort of disorganized and not doesn't flow well. And, but if you can get your hands on that, there's a lot of little interesting tidbits there. The guy is a Burriana collector, actually collects antique beer delivery trucks, right? Think of that as a hobby. Think about that as what they call the wife acceptance factor. These aren't hot rods. These are like beer trucks, you know, in the garage, in the driveway, down the street. I don't know. So when you look at the beer styles, the beers that are the wit beers and those associated beers and also the lambic type of beers, truly ancient beers. And it does appear that a lot of the beer styles in East and West Flanders, in Dutch-speaking Flanders, are pretty well connected to the regional styles that were there in the 19th century. But when you get to the east and the south of the country, all bets are off. And I'm going to show you a map in a minute. But the sources I'm using right now on these guys is this guy named Lacambre. I think his first name was Georges. I'm not 100% sure. It's always just G. Lacambre. And that was a massive two-volume brewing and distilling book, a very technical book. This guy was a brewmaster in Leuven and also later then in Ghent. And he brewed at a brewery called La Grande Brasserie in Ghent. And he was brewing like 150 hectoliter-sized batches using steam-jacketed, cast-iron, cylindrical, mechanically stirred pressure vessels to do mashing, to do conversion of unmalted grain, right? So he took the old wit beer recipes, which had been this crazy turbid mash thing that took 7, 8, 10 hours, and modernized that process and really laid the groundwork for the work that later that Schwartz and Siebel in the United States would do that led to the creation of American adjunct lager beer. So I don't have the link yet, but the timing is right, the information right, so the Belgians may have created light beer. So it's kind of, in a way, sort of poetic justice that now they own the largest producer of that. Weird, huh? Isn't history fun? So I'm trying to go back to Schwartz and see who he cites and see if he cites Lacambre, because Lacambre did a lot of work on it. Anyway, Lacambre's a big deal. And then later, there's two guys named Cartuvels and Stammer in 1888. Both of these books are in French, by the way. And then you find a lot of journal articles written for the Journal of the Institute of Brewers in particular. Those are the ones I've been able to find. There are Belgian brewing journals, but I don't have access to them. I'd love to get my hands on some of those. G.M. Johnson, George Maw Johnson, was actually the editor of the La Petite Brasseur, or the Belgian Brewers Journal, from, I don't know, 1870 to maybe around 1900 or a little bit later. I'm not exactly sure where his tenure was. So he knew the industry really well. And also a guy named Thatcher, another guy named Evans, who did a lot of work in the Nord region of France. And that's that part that's up in the far northwest corner of Belgium, and you just go into France, that's where that is, like Dunkirk and stuff right around there. It's just way up on the northwest. And they had a very similar brewing culture to Belgium, because, of course, they were part of the same country and culturally very much the same over there. So this is a little map I put together the other day. There's a lot of information on here. This is 13 separate regional styles that Lacambre spends about 35 or 40 pages in the book describing. So he gives you really a lot of detail on mashing. He actually does talk about color in for all these beers. So we'll just talk about this slide for a little bit. If you look at the green blob on the upper left, that's a beer called Oitzet. And Oitzet literally means outside in Flemish or Dutch. I don't know why that, it's unclear what the meaning is, why the beer is called that. But that beer was an amber-colored beer, and then just below it, that gold-colored one or orangish-colored one was a darker variety of a beer that was made more or less the same way. And these beers were often brewed, all the beers that he describes are brewed in two strengths, and sometimes a third weak beer. But these two beers were often old sour beer blended in various proportions with new fresh weaker beer. Right? Does that sound familiar to anybody? Like the Rodenbach, like the Flemish Reds and the Flemish Browns? That's where those come from, we're pretty sure. Oitzet seems to line up really nicely with those beers. And if you see, there's Kortrijk there and Rosselaer and Oudenaarde, those are cities that are all sort of associated with that region. And I just put these borders on them, made these blobs just kind of, he doesn't give clear boundaries, so I just sort of fuzzed them out at the edge. So these are a little bit dicey. It may have been that those kind of extended a little bit further south. It seems likely that they would have, but I just went with cities that he mentioned specifically and included them. And then you get around Brussels, you see the little light green. That's the sort of crescent-shaped area for lambic production, still exists today with Lambeque and Brussels. And then above that, there was a beer called Bière de Mechelen. And Mechelen beer was a really dark brown-colored beer. You see those arrows on all these things, too. And those were the places that that Lacombe describes where these beers were shipped, right? So the beers in the north of Belgium tended to be shipped up to Holland. And, of course, up until 1878, Belgium and Netherlands were one country. So that border should really be a dotted line for Lacombe, period. So it was not a border really at all on that north there. So Antwerp beers tended to go north. Antwerp makes a beer called Lorge d'Anvers. Seems to have maybe some similarities with what we see as modern Antwerp beers, which would be the Belgian pale ale category classically. But those beers are also very similar to English pale ales, and there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that English pale ales definitely had their strong influence on Belgian beers post-World War I. So it's a little bit of an open question, not real clear. Then there's a beer called Bière de Lierre, paler colored beer. Then you find a very specialized beer called a Diest beer that was a very poorly attenuated beer, almost like a malt tonic or caramel malt beer that you would find, or in America they called them malt tonics. Very heavy, very rich, very good for nursing mothers. Low alcohol, lots of richness to them, lots of malty sugar and things. And that apparently was shipped pretty widely because that was a widely discussed beer. I don't really know the shipping pattern, but it seemed to have been a specialty that kind of got around. And then on to the upper right, you find this large blobby green area, kind of turquoise area, for beers that were associated with, called Bières de Maastricht. And Maastricht today is in the Netherlands. You can see it's just outside the border, but culturally that region's all similar. And that runs all the way up the Meuse River that runs up into Holland. And a lot of that beer went even further north, and they even brewed some of that up in Rotterdam, which is even further off the map. So, and that was definitely a sour beer, definitely a dark sort of almost lambic type of beer. I think the Oud Maastricht was being brewed up until maybe 10 years ago, and then that brewery stopped making it for some inexplicable reason. Maybe nobody wanted to buy that beer in Maastricht, but that was pretty recent that got shut down. And then there's the two Witbier towns. We know Hoegaarden because of Pierre Celis and the revival that he did, but in its day, Leuven was much more famous and sold an awful lot more beer. And Lacombe says of Hoegaarden, it's like, well, no, it's very unimportant, but I thought I would just mention it, right? And it turns to be, it was a paler colored beer, and it resembles our modern version of wit beer. The Leuven beers were a little darker. He describes them as sort of an amber colored beer, or light amber, or yellow beer, rather than a white beer, really pale. And they also brewed a dark beer called Petermann that was actually more popular in the 19th century than the wit beer was. So, and it was dark. It had a lot of these beers, they boiled for 7, 8, 10 hours to get a dark color. And often they added calcium oxide to the beer to raise the pH, which hastens browning. That's why pretzels are dark, right? Because they're boiled in lye, which raises the pH, which changes the Maillard chemistry and allows them to darken down a little bit. Changes the flavor, too. Lacombe didn't think that was a very good technique, by the way. And then you find down on the bottom, you find this Bière Lorge de Wallonie. Of course, Wallonia is the culturally French part of Belgium and the southern half of Belgium. You can see the dotted line that runs through the middle of the country. That's the Dutch and French linguistic and cultural dividing line there, with Belgium kind of being a little bit of both. And so we have that thing going all the way down there to Mons. Still not so nice beers being brewed down there. Another beer within that region called a Bière de Liège. And we'll get to Liège beer because it's really important on the next point. So just a few things about what's in the book. All these books or various sources quote things. Lacombe says, we're brewing with grains of paradise, ginger, what else? Coriander, orange peel. And he goes, of course, we all understand these are English spices for beer. And if you look at the old English books for the home brewer, the house breweries, there's recipes with all those ingredients. So the Belgians were getting that stuff from the English, apparently, which is interesting, right? Because we think of those things as so Belgian today. The other thing is that, like I said, most of the beers come in two strengths. The strongest beer in Belgium in 1895, as described by George Johnson, was 1065. That's really different from our knowledge of beer today. Most of them, the strong beers were of 1040 to 1050, and the weak beers were 1020 to 1030. Right, that was a typical range there. And that 1063 beer was a spontaneously fermented beer. So that's also weird that that would be the strongest beer in Belgium at the time. Doesn't really make sense. And we do know that there were blended beers with old beers and new beers. What's not in there? Really important question. There's no mention of Abbey beer. Right? There's no mention of, man, we sure miss those old beers that they used to brew 100 years ago. Not there. Doesn't happen. So there's a big gap there. We'll talk a little more about it. There's no mention of any kind of farmhouse brewing or small scale or things like that. Just not there. Not one mention that I've ever found in either of those books of the word triple. That's a much more modern term. Comes into play in the 1930s or maybe a little earlier. And none of these books recommend spices for any particular style. So even though we think of today a wit beer as demanding orange peel and coriander and maybe some secret ingredient, not there. Now, he said they used them, but we're left to wonder in what and for what purpose. We don't know. And I don't think he was a big proponent of them. It may have been more small-scale guys doing it. I don't know. And then when you get to 1900 or so, or even this is 1883, these guys are saying it's been 30 years since the Belgian beers were considered among the best of Europe. Right, that was when Lacombe was brewing 30 years ago, and by this period of time, and even later, it got even worse. So these describe really the guys like George Maw Johnson and Evans describe these beers as the breweries as being dirty and in disarray, and everybody's dispirited, and the beers are incredibly weak. People are drinking gin. Maybe that's why the beer's terrible. Maybe that's the reason they're drinking gin. I don't know. You know, and then. This guy named Henri Van Leer, who was the president of the Brewers Guild at the time, decided to have a competition to make some export-grade beer for Belgium that they could be proud of because the way the tax structure was and because of the economies of scale of the larger breweries in France, or I'm sorry, in England, Scotland, and Germany, they could sell good quality beer into the market in Belgium cheaper than the Belgians themselves could make it. And, of course, the tastes were changing. Pilsners were starting to become popular, the Bock beers, things like that. They have no real counterparts in Belgian brewing. Lacombe categorically states in like the first paragraph where he's talking about beer, Belgian beer is all about wheat. And even the beers we call barley beers, yeah, they got wheat in them too. And it's a rare beer in that book that doesn't have any wheat in it. And if it doesn't have wheat, it might have spelt. Right, so it was very much that kind of thing. That was their original cultural tradition. Lambic and Witbier fits right in that. But all this other stuff we think about Abbey beers and stuff, that came much later and was much more influenced by other things. Of course, in World War I, the country was just totally trashed. They took all the metal out of the breweries, all the brass and copper. The average gravity of a beer, of a starting gravity at the end of World War I was 2 degrees Plato. Right, think of that. They were cutting up sugar beets and throwing them into the kettle. I hate beets. But all the brewers that talk about raw beet sugar says, oh, it's nasty. Don't do it. And then, you know, we have this problem with Trappist beers and monastery beers. French Revolution shut them all down in 1789 because those guys who started the revolution, that was one of the people they were mad at, was the church for conspiring with aristocratic families to dominate the people, right? So they shut all the monasteries down, and Belgium was part of France at the time, so done. And it wasn't really until, 70 years later, 60 years later, more two generations at least, that the first monastery reopened. And there's no real record of any of them brewing beer at all until you get to 1836, and then 1860s, you find Westmalle, or I think it was Chimay, actually brewing a little beer for themselves. But you don't really find monastic beer being sold to the public until the 1920s. So really quite a big jump, you know, through that period of time, almost 100 years, 80 years anyway. Trappistin beer was registered by Westmalle in the 30s. I think the association wasn't really formed until after World War II. I'm not 100% sure on that. I should look in that. Standa has a lot of nice work on these in his Brew Like a Monk book, so I would highly recommend, if you're interested in this, dig into Stan's book. First triple, 1934, Westmalle. And that was definitely influenced by Pilsner. You know, the Pilsner malts were not available in the early 19th century. Monks would have never been brewing anything like that. And, Pilsner was a huge juggernaut. There were German breweries setting up shop in Belgium, as they were in France. There was a public taste for paler, lighter-colored, golden beers that they hadn't really had before. Glass drinking vessels were becoming cheaper and more widely available. So all these things that happened in England, too. So that was triple. These are some old labels. I love old labels because they can give you information. There's Chimay on the right, Shkapskoy, that's La Trappe. And then two other ones you never really heard of. Lamazza was a larger commercial brewery, and they were apparently making some kind of Abbey type of beer. And there's another Trappist there that I don't recognize that name. I don't really know what it is. But there it is, Cardinal Trappist. That would probably be as early as the 1930s and maybe as late as the 1950s, just by the graphic design style. It's hard to tell sometimes with labels. And then there was a huge fondness for all things English at the end of World War I, because we saved their asses. It was a horrible thing. England came over, donated a lot of millions of people to the cause against Germany, and helped win the war along with the Americans at the end. And then, so there was actually this brewery, this label. If you see that name, it was Brasserie des Alliés, the Brewery of the Allies. And that was sort of in tribute to the troops, the Allied troops from England, Scotland, the rest of the Commonwealth, and also from the U.S. And they were brewing. I've got another picture of a cart where they show the beers, and they were definitely making IPA in that brewery in England. Of course, there would have been a lot of troops there still. You know, they would have been probably trying to pander to the taste of the English troops as well. But you start to see these beers pop up about that time, and also a lot of lager type of beers. They didn't really call them pills so much. They called them blonde beers or double blondes, or sometimes you see triple blonde, and then Bock beer and Beer de Mars. But Beer de Mars, most of the old recipes for Beer de Mars is like the last runnings. It's true with Lambic. Like, they make a beer called Mars beer with Lambic, and it's what's blended in to make Faro. And it's a really like fifth runnings. It's really, really weak. And so generally in 19th century Belgium, when you see Beer de Mars, it's the weakest beer. Not like what we think of in German, like being a stronger, more of a Märzen type of beer. It was something very different than that. Why it had that name, I don't really know. Another mystery there, right? So here's another one. Beautiful Fiction, farmhouse beer. Who doesn't like a farmhouse beer? It just conjures up so many beautiful images, and I think it's one of the reasons why those beers are catching the imagination of so many people in this room and in commercial breweries, because it just sounds delicious. But when you actually go and look in the record, you really find little evidence of it. And so there's this story that I thought Michael Jackson had told it, and I went back to World Guide to Beer and looked to see what he's had to say about saisons. And this was his first book in the late 70s, and there's one sentence in the book about saisons, and it is something like, in certain parts of southern Belgium, some of the brewers call their top fermented beers saisons. That's it. So today, you know, we have a very different idea of that, but that was what Jackson had to say. To him, it was not a very minor thing and almost not worthy of even mentioning. So there wasn't anything that was just a saison style at that time in the 1970s. It certainly has changed since then. And if you think also, so the story is, well, you know, we make this beer, we call saison. In French, saison means season, and summer is a season, so we call the beer saison. Right. Doesn't make any sense to me either. The other story they tell is that the beer is for saisonniers, which means the seasonal workers. And the seasonal farm workers, basically migrant workers, we want to give them a beer that's strong enough to sustain them in the fields, but not so strong that they'll be really drunk. And if you look at modern saison, it's 6.5% or so and up. And like that, in old days, that's like the strongest beer in Belgium. And if like think about how people treat their farm workers. Not real good. And are you going to give them beer at all? Well, maybe you had to, but if you're not going to give them your best beer. you're going to give them your worst beer. Because not only do you not want them drinking and getting drunk while you're paying them to work, you don't really even like them. Because they're seasonal workers. You know, I mean, that's just the way it is. Maybe it was different in Belgium. I don't know. But you, sometimes it's common. You just always have to apply that common sense filter to things. And that's an example of that. So we don't know. So what does farmhouse really mean? I looked around and tried to find a lot of pictures. And generally when you find pictures of breweries in northern France or Ardennes area of France and in Belgium, they tend to look like this. And if you, and the books bear this description out, and the descriptions by Evans and G.M. Johnson all sort of bear this out, that these were small economic enterprises. You can see in that picture, you've got a dozen people working there. You got to have four, five, six brewers because you got to stir that mash, right? And that's like a lot of that was hand work. Lacombre at one point says you need six or eight robust brewers stirring this mash vigorously. And it was thick mashes that would have taken a lot of work. So there's the brewers. Then you got to have a guy making barrels and a guy helping him. You got horses. You got to have a guy driving the horses. You got to have guys beer carrying the beer around. You got to have guys taking care of horses and shoveling out the horse poop. You got to have the women doing the things that women generally did in those days, which was sort of helping take care of the men and keeping the place civilized to some degree, maybe doing some cooking or I don't know, you know, but there's always women in these pictures too. So this is a pretty typical scenario. And when you look at these are breweries that the French region of Nord has a cultural ministry that has a ton of great photo documentation. We don't have it in Belgium, so we don't have really Belgian pictures, but everything we know, these regions were very similar in terms of their production scale. And so these are all breweries that are described as being breweries that are attached to farms or as part of an agricultural enterprise. And you can see they're large buildings. We've got a big smokestack. That would have been that same scale of building. And these are not little house type breweries where there's a woman in the kitchen making beer for the farm workers. You know, that just doesn't seem to have existed. So, and there's one down in the Ardennes. And the house is quite old, but the brewery was glommed onto it in the 1700s. So, and that, again, is another one that was specifically a farm type of beer in a farmhouse that was converted into a brewing. So it's really different. And then we have this other problem is the name. And which, as I already said, so the only beer in Belgium properly called a saison was from Liège. And if you remember from the map, I'll show you another map in a minute. Liège is all the way over on the very far eastern border at the southern tip of Netherlands. And that's quite a ways away, you know, 2 hours by car anyway, from the region where today saisons are famous. So how that name got over there, I don't know. And it was a really weird beer. There's the gravities there. It always contained malted spelt. It often contained oats, sometimes contained buckwheat or broad beans. And it was brewed with a special yeast that they got from Maastricht that fermented only 50%. So it was a very poorly attenuated beer, so very low alcohol, and really weird beer, and nothing in any way like our modern saison beers. So there's a mystery for you. And it was also described as being quite amber by Lacombre, so because he was very specific about it. We do know that the word en saison means brewed in season, meaning brewed during winter, meaning a full-strength beer. Because only the full-strength, in summer, only weak beers were brewed. So that is those lower gravity singles, or they had a lot of different names for strong and weak beer in different regions. But and then he describes also further saying, it's really a harsh drink. You know, everybody drinks a lot of gin, so it's just not very good. So I don't know. And it was aged a few months also. So pretty strange. Here's some, but then you get to the 1930s, and here all of a sudden saison pops up. And I'm going to show you the map in a second. These are all in western Belgium, right around there, around in Hainaut and Wallonian Brabant. Pipai, Brasserie Vapeur, Tourps is DuPont, Mons, and these other towns in green are where those beers were brewed. And then here's just some weird stuff to ponder. A brown goose, pretty weird. Look who makes that. Brasserie Artois. Stella. Isn't that wacky? Anybody knew they made Belgian, made Lambic? The goose on the center, that's a goose sans acide carbonic. That's a flat goose. That's another mind bender. Well, Witbier from not where Witbier is supposed to become. So just interesting things you can find when you look at those old labels. 2 minutes? All right, I'm gonna skip this slide, and I'm gonna get right to let's talk about steam beer, right? So steam beer, we know the story. We think we know the story. There is some truth to the story. It was a style. Once refrigeration became popular, it faded very quickly. Of a book I have that has more than 3,000 labels in it, there's only 9 steam beer labels. So very uncommon style. So I was always wondered, like, how did this beer come about? Fritz Maytag, I finally got to talk to him and said, what's the story? He said, well, we were trying to brew beer. We're trying to fix the beer. We made a lot of accidental lambics back in those days. So we wanted to take the sugar out, so we're going to make it all malt. So we didn't know anything about malt. We said, let's put some malt in it. So we called the malt guy. Malt guy says, oh, we got this malt called Crystal Malt. It's chewy, raisiny. It's got this nice flavor. It'll give you a little color. And Fritz goes, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Send us some of that. And then he said, then we thought, well, let's make some hops. Put some hops in it. You know, we're modern people. Let's have some hops. And said, we didn't know anything about hops. We called the hop guy. The hop guy said, well, we got this new hops called Northern Brewer. Nobody's really using it. It's got kind of a neat flavor to it. You might like that. And Fritz goes, yeah, send us some of that. There you go. That's Anchor Steam. But what's great about that is that means, without a doubt, that is the first craft beer. Because that standard recipe of pale ale malt and Crystal and some American hops, that's like the precursor to everything we do, right? And it was Fritz and his team that just had that, like, what the hell kind of attitude to make the beer. And you got to love that, you know? So, again, that's a better story than this being some kind of relic, you know? So I think that's really super cool. I'll leave you with one more just to ponder. I don't know if you can read that. It says, ale and beer. Extract bovis cum malto. So, anyway, I got 2 new books. There's a lot more. So I got 2 new books. We have the Mastering Homebrew book for sale out here in the thing. They're both out now. The description in the catalog was written some time ago, but check it out. And thanks a lot for coming out to my talk. I appreciate it.